Okay, great. So welcome back to lecture number two. We're going to talk today about bits and switches, which is basically the first section, or maybe the first two sections of the book. But we have some administrative stuff that we're going to do first. So let's kind of dive into that. So how we doing on clickers? Does anybody not have a plan for getting a clicker yet? Can you make a plan to make a plan?
Yeah, I didn't know.
Okay. All right. Do you know where to look?
This is the first time I'm hearing about clickers.
Okay. So we have these things called iClickers. They're supposedly available in the bookstore along with the books. Did anybody buy them there? Is that where you get them?
Yeah.
So was it hard? Any tricks that you want to share?
No.
You had
bookstore. It's expensive.
Which bookstore? So there's Rutgers bookstore, but then there's supposedly another one.
New Jersey Books.
And you were there?
Oh, I only know about the
New Jersey Books?
The College app one.
The College
Books and the Rutgers University.
So we have positive confirmation on two bookstores. That would be people who actually bought them would know. What are they charging?
It's like $30.
All right. The book, though, is?
Like $15.
15?
Are you talking 50 for this? Okay.
Oh.
Hi. Is this
the what?
Is this too close? Is it?
Is it too close? No, it's fine with me. If you're, we can help you with that, too.
Do I need batteries in this guy?
No, it
doesn't. It has batteries.
Oh, okay.
But you may need to go back and visit Charles in the back for a night unless you have very sharp things in your purse, which would scare me. So maybe you should go back regardless of what's in your purse. All right. So the way this is going to work, so some of you may, who's had experience with clickers before? Any kind of experience. So a lot of us, this is very new to us. Those of you who've seen these before, every company seems to have a different way of doing it. Some make you buy the clicker, some make you buy a textbook and get the clicker, some make you give you the clicker, but then they make you register every semester that you use it. What you've got, those of you who have them, is just a device that you bought, like other devices that you could buy, you know, like a can opener. It's just useful in a different way for your can opener.
Thank you.
So it's yours, and so you don't have to register, you don't have to do anything fancy with it. What I do need to know, though, is if you'll notice, on the back of each of the clickers... Oh, I gave away all my clickers. Look at the back of the clicker. There should be a code. Yeah. That code is... What did we talk about last time? We talked about decimal, which is base 10, like things that are 0 through 9, digit sequence 0 through 9. We also talked about... What other number system? What's that? The number system. There was a series of steps where we went from a series of digits, decimal digits, to another series of digits, and then to the bars.
The ones and zeros.
The ones and zeros. Remember what that was called?
Binary.
Binary. Right. So there's a number system called decimal, which is the one that we're mostly familiar with. There's binary, which is deep down what computers generally use. But binary, to write a sequence of a reasonable sized number in binary, requires lots and lots of bits. And so 100111111. It's very hard for people to do. So there's a shorthand for binary, which is actually base 16, better known as hexadecimal. That's right. The back of your clicker has a hexadecimal code on it. You can tell it's hexadecimal because it's going to have digits like 0 through 9, but it can also have A, B, C, D, E, and F, which stand for essentially 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. Just like decimal goes up to one, you know, decimal is base 10, it goes up to one number less than 10. Binary is base 2, it goes up to one number less than 2. Hexadecimal is base 16, it goes up to one number less than 16, which is 15. So the biggest single digit in hexadecimal is F. So some of you may have Fs. Don't worry, it's not a grade or anything. It's just a code. So at some point, I need to associate you, person, with a person name with that hexadecimal code. There is a program that comes with the iClicker software that lets you do that. What it does is it puts everybody's name up on the screen, actually scrolls it up on the screen. I'm not showing it to you because it's not working yet. Puts everybody's name up on the screen like credits, and next to each of your names there'll be one of the letters A, B, C, D, or E, like on your clicker. When your name comes up with a letter next to it, you push your letter on your clicker, and I think, you know, if we do this fast enough, it should actually then record, oh, that was your name. You press that button, that means whichever clicker pressed that button is you. It links them together and puts them in a file so I know who's who. We did all the steps of that up until it actually working, where it didn't. So I'm going to keep working on that for next time, and we'll hopefully be able to demonstrate that and find out who's who. So today you're basically, at least temporarily, anonymous when you use the clickers. Yeah, so there's this thing. Can you see it up on the screen? Yes. So I click on roll call, and it's supposed to now scroll through all of your names. And what basically what it's saying here is now scrolling, dash, up next, nobody. So it has no idea who you are, which is sad because we made a file with everybody's name in it exactly to make this work. All righty. So we're going to skip that today, and I will go straight to the other administrative things. Let's see if I can get back into that. All right, so the question, let's see if we can get these to work. The answer was, no, we cannot, not today. All right, so the most common question I've gotten since last time is what the grading scheme is going to be. This is my first cut at the grading scheme. I'm going to reserve 20% of the class grade for in-class participation, which means coming, using your clickers, answering the questions. I will put more weight on answering a question than answering the question right. What I mean by that is you get more credit for answering it right, but you get a lot of credit for just answering it, and then you don't get any credit if you don't answer it. So if you don't come to class, then you can't get credit for that class in terms of the in-class participation. I'm going to assign homework problems to give you a sense of what the exam problems are going to look like. Every 2 weeks, I'm going to put together a set of homework problems that are like exam questions but cover the material that we've been talking about. If everything works out, we'll be able to hand those in online and grade them quickly for you so that you'll get feedback. That was a bit of an issue last semester. Then halfway through the semester, we'll do a midterm. That's worth quarter of the grade. And at the very end, when we have our final slot, we'll have a final, and that'll be cumulative, with probably more emphasis on the stuff that wasn't on the midterm. But if there's stuff that I really hoped you would learn at the midterm and looked like you didn't, then I'll probably ask those on the final, and that'll be worth slightly more than 30%. My goal is not to be tricky, it's just to give you opportunities to show that you're learning the material. And my goal with the homeworks is really just to give you a hint of what the questions on the exams will look like. So I will try to keep them as similar as I possibly can. Okay, so that was a question that came up a lot. Is that answered to people's satisfaction? Do you have other issues? If you don't feel comfortable asking some kind of question in class, just send me an email.
So you said homework's going to be given every 2 weeks?
Yeah, so at the end of each two-week block, I'll find some way of distributing that. I'm still learning how to use the system. So this is, I think that's the next slide here. So I tried to email this out, and so presumably a lot of people actually received this email, giving you this website name. So RikersOnline.net. Has anyone used this in some other class? Yes. Okay. Is it fun? Is it good? Is it going to make us all crazy? Or are we okay with this?
It's homework online. I mean, it's not fun. It's just, I took an online course for that, so.
Oh, you actually did the whole course was online. Okay. All right. But not as a supplement to a more live.
I did that too.
You did that as well. All right. So this is new to me, but it was being pushed sort of top down a little bit from the Rutgers administration. As a computer scientist, this is true actually across the country. I've been to many different schools, and almost all schools have a university-wide computing center that actually takes care of computer needs for everybody, and the computer science departments don't like to be a part of that. And I don't know if it's elitism, or we have different needs, or we think we can do a better job. Whatever it is, computer science departments tend to have their own computer system that they administer themselves. And so I generally, as computer scientist for as long as I can remember, have participated in that. So I don't generally know a lot about university-wide computer centers. But, maybe this is good. Maybe this is helpful to you. You guys are outside the computer science department. Anyway, I'd like to come to you as much as I can and try to make it easy for you. So this is my goal with this. If this is making us crazy, if we get like a quarter of the way through the semester or halfway through the semester, and we're all going nuts because it doesn't do anything the way we want it to do it, we'll just pull the plug. We'll find some other way to get things done. But the main goal here is that there's a syllabus. There's various links. There's a calendar that I haven't quite figured out how to use yet. So when things become scheduled, like exams, I can put them in the calendar. When homeworks become due, I can put them in the calendar. And supposedly, you guys can just go to the site. It knows who you are. It knows which classes you're in. It knows that this class is in the system. It should just do the right thing. Has anyone had it do the right thing? Yeah, so did you try for this class? For other classes. So I set it up for this class as well. So I'd like everybody to go there and try it. If you can't log in, there should be instructions that I didn't write. So that's, good and bad for you. It means that they're probably better than if I had written them, but then if it's broken, I can't help you. But give it a try. Send me feedback. we have, the TAs and I will try to do the best that we can to just make this work smoothly. But if things aren't working right away, it just, you know, bear with us. I'm certainly not going to penalize you for the difficulties in getting started, so don't worry about that.
Are you going to be posting lectures?
So currently on that site now, there's the slides from the first lecture and slides from this lecture. I'll try to do as much in advance as I can. You may have noticed that there's two sets of slides being constructed. One is the slides from this semester. One is the slides from last semester. If you want to bring either an electronic copy or a paper copy of the slides to class, and I haven't finished putting the finishing touches on that day's lecture, you can go to the last semester's. A lot of it's going to be the same. But I will be updating them as I go and in various ways, things that I thought were broken last time, just to keep it synced up.
Yes. So go to this site instead of the one that you gave us.
So at the moment, both sites have both sets of things. So it shouldn't matter which site you go to, but we should try to get in the practice of going to this one. Off of this site, there is a link to last year's site, which has all last year's lectures. Then there is directly linked to that page, like on it. I think I actually have copies of it at this website, the lectures that I've done so far this semester. So they should be easily downloadable directly.
It's the same thing as RevCT, isn't it?
I don't think so. Which is another, RevCT is a competing, I think it's trying to be like that. And I think maybe Rutgers has three different ways of doing this, which makes it a little hard for me to believe that there's kind of one right way. I don't know, somehow they were making it sound like this was the official one. Again, if it sucks, we can just fix it. Yeah.
So the notes you had online for more of the masters.
The note I have all.
So I printed out today is in next class, so they're not.
Next class is last semester's next class, which will be really similar, but I haven't updated yet. When you print out today's, it depends when you did it. If you did it,
couple hours.
Then it's probably the new one. Look, if you look at the front, it'll actually say fall or spring.
Fall. So.
That's today.
Okay, good.
All right. In addition to lecture notes, which I'll be putting up, we're trying something new because, you know, you can't have too many new things, podcasts. So, which means probably less to me than it may to some of you, but it's the audio form of the lecture. There's a video camera in the back. It's just basically recording my voice. You can listen to me, anywhere you want, I guess. I don't know why you want to do that, but we're going to try this out and see if people find it useful. I think ultimately they will actually be lined up with the slides. So there will be. So I don't have this kind of iPod. I only have a little tiny one that looks like a stick of gum. It's just those audio. But I understand that people who have cooler toys than I do have video iPods that actually have a little screen on it. Ultimately, the screen will actually have the slides timed with my voice, done actually by hand, unfortunately. It should be done automatically, but we're not there yet. So, okay. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I read Newsweek, and Newsweek sometimes talks about, you know, what's going on in the world. So this is how I try to find out what's going on in the world. And they say that a lot of universities are doing these podcast things. And one impact is that it's really convenient. If you miss a class, you can catch up. It's not very difficult. You have this as a resource. On the other hand, a lot of people don't show up for class then because they can just get more or less the same experience on their own. MP3 players. It would be great for me if you actually came to class. And it would actually be good for being able to use the clickers, because that's a little hard to do with the podcast. So let's just see how this works out. It is a little bit overwhelming. If you really feel lost, please contact us. Even if you feel just a little lost. Alright. So here's what I'd like to do next. I'd like to try out the clickers that we've got and also to kind of show you what kind of reading comprehension questions I'm interested in. I made up a series of questions, which we should be able to view. It's not in the notes. Okay.
Should we copy these down? Like, are they going to be on the exam?
The question, no, these questions are very specifically oriented towards just making sure that you are doing the readings and listen to lecture. The homework questions are going to be much more like the exam. All right. So, what we figured out last time is that we can't actually have the slide view and the clicker stuff happening simultaneously. So, I'm going to zoom out a little bit. Okay, so this is now readable, I claim. You can see there's other garbage on the screen, but this should be readable. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start the clicker going. So the next... Oh, I know why that is. All right. Okay, I don't know why that is. Interesting. I would like that to stop. Okay, all right. For the next 30 seconds... It's just going to fix. Tell me it's fixing. There it goes. All right. For the next 20 seconds, you can answer the following question about me. This is something that I brought up in the lecture last time. If you don't know the answer, you can guess. Check it out. You're doing it. Woo-hoo. If you click multiple times, it will remember the last click that you did. At least this version of the software. We're going to try to hack it a little bit. Okay. Yes?
If you don't have a clicker yet...
You just have to think the letter really loudly on the right radio frequency, and it'll be cool. No, I understand that some people are not all set up yet, so you won't get clicker credit for today, but I think what was suggested to me is that in computing the class participation score, I will take some number of days in which you didn't respond and just drop them from the computation. So if there's a day you forgot to clicker, a day you can't come to class, there's some amount of flex in that. So just don't panic. But, you can answer on this paper or something. All right, good. So in principle now, we should be able to do this. Okay. All right, so this is now a barcode of what people responded. It turns out that the most popular answer was, in fact, the answer I was looking for. That in this particular way of breaking down the fields of computer science, I'm in AI. All right, now I need to hide this so you can't sneakily... answer what everybody else is answering. All right. Next question, which will start now. So last time we talked about barcodes. There's a 12-digit barcode. The last digit plays a particular role. It has a particular interpretation. See if you can remember what that was. All of these are actually relevant to barcodes. Cool. All right. Good timing. So we'll do the display on this one as well. Oh, yeah. All right. So, yes, that is the check digit. That's a digit that's computed as a combination of the other digits so that the scanner can tell if there was a one-digit error in the scan. Very good. All right. Not the right place to. I think what I'm going to do is write an actual program to display these questions, because doing it in Keynote is awkward. Okay, all right, good. All right. This is a question that I get asked a lot by people who don't read the book. There's a fifth answer. I hope that's not the right one. Yeah, just ignore E. That's not fitting on the screen. I'll show it to you afterwards. It's not the right answer. Oh, slower to answer because it's more to read. Last one just before. I see that. All right. So, So this is answered in the very beginning of the preface. We can see not everyone's gotten a chance to look at the preface yet. And so things are kind of balanced between two different answers. The Rosetta Stone answer, which I chose. I was at a bat mitzvah over the weekend, and I was actually not paying attention, and I was reading the textbook. And, respectfully, of course. And somebody said, oh, what does stone mean? Is that Rosetta Stone? So I thought, oh, that's a good... wanted to put up as not the right answer. So it's not the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone is an awesome, awesome story, but it is not connected to the use of the word stone in the book. Early computers were extremely big, like room-sized and multi-tons. So the idea of a portable computer at that point really kind of nobody could imagine how that could be. But in fact, they didn't call it the stone. I just made that up. In fact, there are computer networks all over the Earth, and like third rock from the sun and all that, but this is not it either. The reason he chose it in the book is that The patterns on the stone are the circuitry that's etched into the silicon on the computer chips. And he tells this nice little story in the beginning of the preface where he says, if he were to describe his job over the last decade or so to a person from, early America, he'd be burned as a witch because it just sounds like witchcraft and wizardry. So he kind of reveled in that. That was cute. All right, so what was D? E was actually a clever pun that only I would get. That's not right. Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. And then there was Peter Stone, who's a colleague of mine, but it's not named after him. All right, next question. One clicker came out of nowhere. We didn't have 20 on any of the other ones, did we? That was just 19. Okay. Good. So does anybody get this? I don't mean joke in a funny sense. This is meant in a tongue-in-cheek way. Does anybody get this, John? Do you know this reference? So Hillis has claimed to fame. The first reason I knew about Danny Hillis, I actually worked for him at a company called Thinking Machine. Because he had designed, as part of his PhD thesis, he designed a 65,000 processor computer, which was this giant black square, made of these big black cubes and then all sorts of flashing LED lights on it, which I'm sure did nothing except make it look, cool and militaristic, I guess. But it was called the Connection Machine. So that was the name of his computer, and he called it that because all the 65,000 processors, there was an interconnect, like a network inside the computer so they could talk to each other. But in fact, let's see what we got display-wise. D, right. So in fact, in the preface, he describes a computer as being an imagination machine, which is just the most sort of poetic way I've ever heard a computer described. But really what it lets you do is you think of a thought, you encode it so that the computer can kind of take it and go with it, and things just happen. And it's really and that's one of the things I think that a lot of us are excited about, what makes it fun, is because it can take these ideas and take them further than we can on our own. And the E answer, which didn't fit on the screen, was simulation machine, which, it's all of these things, but I like the idea of it being an imagination machine. Oops. Okay, all right. So in chapter one, he talks about building a computer-like thing out of switches and lights. That should be did Hillis, not to Hillis, sorry. Alright, yeah, this was faster than me. So this is really useful. So now I know that the amount of time that you need to answer grows with the number of words in the choices. Because presumably you're reading that. Which makes, in retrospect, makes an awful lot of sense. Alright, so in fact, he talked about tic-tac-toe, that's right. And I'm going to use a similar example in the lecture today. I'm going to talk about the game NIM, which is A. So if you haven't heard of it before, I'm going to be introducing that shortly.
I have a question.
Yeah, shoot.
If you switch your answer, it registers
it does the second one. Okay. Yeah, unless you do three, in which case it takes the third. It's whatever's left. You override it. All right. Awesome. All right. So thank you for that experiment. That was very instructive. So what am I trying to do meanwhile? Good. Get back to this. All right, good. All right, so now we're into the lecture. We'll have the iClickers come back up again, but not for a little while. So you can just kind of chill and go along for the ride. So in the preface, Hillis talks about functional abstraction. This is basically what, in the first lecture, I called reduction, this idea that you construct something complicated by making simple things that have well-defined jobs to do, and then you build on top of them more complicated things that do more complicated jobs, using the smaller things as subparts. He also mentions universality, which we'll talk about more later. I don't think I'm going to spend any time on it now. He used the phrase imagination machines, which I thought was very poetic. All right, so if you get down to the bottom of what's going on here, lots of fields have their own bottom. One of the things that makes fields different is what they take to be their, you know, the primitive operation, the primitive object. Chemistry, it's all about molecules, right? Once you go into molecules, then you're pretty happy. Everything else is going to be built on top of that. Physics, now there's string theory, which says that basically everything that you can think about in physics can be made out of these vibrating strings. Which I have a lot of trouble imagining, but that's what they say. Some of them are very thin, I'm told. In mathematics, set theory can play this role. So once you define set, you just kind of imagine them out of nothingness, and then everything else can be built on top of it. In computer science, it's bits, zeros and ones. The smallest unit of information. We're going to sometimes call them true and false. Those are the two bits, one and zero. Sometimes use their numeric form, one and zero. Sometimes we'll call them on and off. True is on, false is off. Does anybody recognize this symbol? Yeah, so why is this the power symbol? How does that mean power? You might imagine. Well, go ahead. Does anyone want to guess? What do you think?
One means on, zero means
off. So it's in particular, what kind of switch has this button? It's not on-off switches like light switches, right? What kind of switches have this button? Yeah?
Where like you turn it on and off with the same button.
With the same button, right? It's a toggle switch, right? And so for a while, I kind of pictured this as a finger pushing the button. But I don't think that's what it is. I think this is a one and a zero. The same button turns the machine on, one, and off, zero. So this is actually, you know, the bits. This is a little picture of bits. All right, so what is a bit? So the word bit itself is similar to some other words you're familiar with, like, for example, craptacular, which, you know, maybe you don't use very often. Crumbelievable is another one that I heard recently on TV and enjoyed. These are words that are actually built up out of other words. So craptacular, when people say it, is it's a spectacular, but it's really just crappy. So if you take crap and spectacular and stick them together, and it's craptacular. Crumbelievable, as far as I can tell, is a mixture of crumble and unbelievable. So unbelievable, like unbelievably good, and yet crumbly. It's used to describe cheese, but Stephen Colbert did a really funny bit on it recently, and so I decided that it must be cooler than just cheese. Words that have this property are called portmanteau words. They're words that are just other words stuck together. And it's a fun way to make up a word. And you can make up words this way kind of by accident. But actually, in this case, this is a really beautiful portmanteau word. It's actually, bit comes from binary digit. So it's binary meaning base 2, digit meaning digit, like we've been talking about, 0 through 9 in decimal. So a binary digit, a little cumbersome to say, if you actually align to the middle, you get bit. And it's cool because it's just a bit, right? It's just this tiny little small amount. So it really fits together really well. One of the things that Hillis does in the book a lot is he name drops. So he names these really famous, really influential computer scientists, and he talks about how he had classes with them, or he went to lunch with them and hung out with them and stuff. And he's just much better connected than I am. So I can't quite do that. But I can do it one step removed in this case. So I know his nephew, Paul Tukey, who is a very famous statistician. I don't know John Tukey. I think John Tukey is dead now. Claude Shannon is also dead now. It makes it harder to kind of get to know these people. So as we've been talking about, we talked about this the last time as well, that these bits are, it's a number system just like, it can be thought of as a number system just like our base 10 or decimal number system. In base 10, you can take on, a digit can take on any value 0 through 9. In base 2, just 0 and 1. That's all you can do. Could we go any lower than that? What would be less than binary? If you just had to make up a word. What is this? Go ahead. Monary. Anybody else? Monary makes sense, but that's not the word that people actually use for this. It's one is Greek and one is Latin. That helps. I think mono is Greek. What's the Latin for one?
Union.
Yeah. So do you.
Unit decimal.
Well, you know, that would make some sense. But deci actually means 10. Unary is a word that gets used sometimes, which would sort of mean base 1, but there really isn't a good notion of base 1. The closest thing that you get to unary is tallies. You know, like if you're counting up to 10, you put right? That's kind of unary, but it's not really the same kind of number system. You're really, the smallest well-formed numeric number system is when you have a distinction between 0 and 1, and that's binary. Now, Hillis talks a little bit about why why you want to prefer that to say a number system that takes on 100 different values. That's a valid number system. Why do we build computers out of things that are just zeros and ones? Well, for one thing, bits have the property that they're simple. You can't really make it any simpler than that. But yet they're really powerful. Anything that you want to represent, anything that we've been able to figure out how to represent, we've been able to figure out how to represent with bits. So it's limiting. It makes things really simple for the computer, but it doesn't seem to have stopped us from being able to do complicated things with computers either. Anything in the real world that we want to represent, we can find some way of mapping it down to bits. Here's a somewhat philosophical connection here. So, in some sense, it's the most basic difference in the universe, right, philosophically. So this is a nice etching by a guy named Escher, M.C. Escher, I think, where zero and one, which one is, like the zebra stripes, right, which is the background and which is the foreground? Well, they both play that role for each other, right? What is zero? It's not one, right? What is one? It is not zero. They're defined by their differences between one another. And so this is a nice drawing that I feel like kind of captures that, where the white here is background, but then it becomes foreground. And here the black is the background, but here it becomes foreground. And so once you have these two distinctions, you can play them off one another. So here's, you could also refer back to the Bible in various ways, or you could talk about Eastern religions, and talk about the yin and the yang, how it's this one fundamental difference that lets you build up a more complicated universe. That was just, you don't have to write any of that down. That was good. I just thought it was very cool. Alright, so how are bits being used in the world around us? Well, so nearly everything these days has gone digital. Even things that used to be information that used to be captured in other forms, generally speaking now, it's all turning digital. And so the two most significant ones that would affect most of us are this idea of digital sound and digital images, or digital pictures. So digital sound is the idea that, how did Edison represent sound on his phonograph? Higher frequency sounds ended up being things that were, I believe, spaced more closely together in the etching and recording on the record player. So there was this analog relationship, this direct relationship between sound waves and the patterns that were actually getting put onto the record player. That's not so much what we're doing anymore. If you listen to music on an iPod, what's actually happening is the sound wave, which is a nice modulation of audio intensity, right? Just this kind of wavy thing, and the details of how the wave looks influence exactly what it's going to sound like to us. What we do these days is we actually take these nice smooth waves, and we turn them into these little clunky chunky waves, where we say, all right, instead of saying, it's smoothly going up and down, we say, all right, in this small sequence of time from here to here, it's gone up this small quantum. It's gone up two steps. And then it goes up three steps. Then it goes up four steps. Then it comes down two. And then, so we can actually capture, if we make the steps between samples, this is time now on this axis, and this is intensity on this axis. If we make the steps small enough in both of these two dimensions, we can capture any smooth wave as closely as we want. We'll never get it exactly right. Because like a diagonal line, you can't really make it out of little jaggy lines, but you can get really close. And that's what these digital music players do. They actually are sampling at such an incredibly fast rate that to us it just sounds completely smooth. But deep down, what's really happening is there's just bits that are saying, okay, what's the intensity at this point? It's a number. What's the intensity at this point? It's a number. And so it's just a sequence of numbers. The circuitry just very rapidly turns that back into sound intensity. And then, it sounds all cool. The same thing can happen with images. So whereas in photography, you have photographic paper, and in photographic paper, there's a mapping from the image that you see in the real world. It gets kind of projected onto that paper, and you can see the image as it is. What we're doing now is we're digitizing images. And what that means is that each at a small enough granularity, there's just little rectangles on the image. And each rectangle has one color in it. Now, I actually was finding it very, very difficult to show you this because the computer doesn't like to show you the hard edges that are around all the pictures. So this is a little picture of a Rutgers football player doing something that I assume made him happy. I zoomed in on that, and you can sort of see that there's these hard edge rectangles that are actually making up the picture. Which you don't notice when they're really, really tiny because they all kind of blend together. My computer wouldn't let me show you this because it kept saying, oh no, that would look bad, let me smooth it for you. And it kept smoothing out the edges on these rectangles because the number of dots on the computer screen on my laptop is enough that if I tell it draw a rectangle like this, it can say, no, I can make that smooth. I can blend that into the other stuff, so you don't even know that it's digital. But that's the kind of the point that I want to make right here, but it didn't listen. So deep down, what's really going on here is there's a whole bunch of very tiny little squares, and each square is one solid color, and that color is named by a number. And we'll talk more about exactly how you do that. But again, what you do is you discretize the different intensities of colors of light. So this is great. So once you have the ability to write numbers in this binary system, you can figure out a way of representing sound and textures and images and elasticities and turbulences. I mean, anything that's in the real world, we can find some way of turning it into these numbers, and then boom, it can be represented with bits. One of the things that makes this work, and the reason that we're doing this, the industry as a whole is doing this a lot more now than, say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is that now we actually can afford to have a whole lot of bits. So let me just, to make this somewhat concrete, there's a kind of iPod that is called 60 gigabyte iPod, and generally when you buy them, they tell you, oh, it can play this number of songs, but that's not really what's going on. It actually has a fixed number of bits that it can hold in its memory at once. And so I want to explain how many bits that is and how they actually translate that into the number of songs. So 60 gigabytes is 60 gigabytes. A gigabyte is 1 billion bytes. Each of these bytes is 8 bits. Okay? So if you think about a bit, it's a 0 or 1, or a position that can hold a 0 or 1. String 8 of them together, we call that a byte, and we write it with a Y. I don't know why. And a half of a byte, by the way, is a nibble, also spelled with a Y, N-Y-B-B-L-E. I didn't mean this stuff. But anyway, a byte means 8 bits, and we just accept that now. You take a billion of them, one after the other, and that's a gigabyte. And you take 60 of those gigabytes, and that's how many bits you can put on an iPod. Now, how does it actually store songs? Well, it uses, and I got this just off of Apple's page, they say, oh, it's 128 kbps. Okay, well, what does that mean? Let's unpack that. This stands for kilobits per second. So a kilobit is 1,000 bits for each second of sound. So if you take a song and you break it up into seconds, one of these seconds that makes up the song is going to, we're going to allocate 1,000 bits to represent everything that happens in that 1 second. And we're just going to string them together, 1 second after the next, to make the whole song. So 62,500 minutes of sound. So if you actually multiply this out, how many, 1,000 bits per second divided by 60 gigabytes of bits gives us 62,500 minutes of sound that you can store. Or, if you think a song takes about 4 minutes, you could say, it's 15,000 songs. Right? But again, there's no slots on the iPod for songs. There's slots for bits. And they just get allocated. Different songs are different lengths, but on average, songs are about 4 minutes long. And so that's where they get numbers like 15,000. It also has a screen on it, a little video display. The screen is 320 by 240 pixels. Now, pixel stands for picture element. It just means a tiny little rectangle or a tiny little square of color. And there's 320, it's just a big grid of it, almost like in a stadium where people can hold up cards and spell things out. Each card we'll call a pixel. So there's 320 columns and 240 rows, so big matrix of pixels. Each one can turn any of a number of different colors. How many different colors? Well, each byte, which stores one byte each for red, green, and blue. So to say that the color of one particular square, what you do is you say, how much red is in this, how much green is in this, how much blue is in this. And the combinations of all those together can specify pretty much all the colors that we can see. How much red? Well, it's some number between 0 and 255. It's the amount of distinctions you can make using 8 bits or 1 byte. So there's 1 byte allocated for saying how much red is in the pixel, 1 for green, and 1 for blue. So that's 76,800 pixels, or 1.8 million bits that are used to show one picture on the screen of the iPod. So these bits, they're very tiny, and you start to spend them really fast. Right? Now, what about video? Video means that we're going to show you a picture, then we're going to take it away, and we're going to show you another picture, and to make it look like it's moving in real time, we actually show you 30 frames of these every second. So every 30th of a second is another picture. And so if you string these together, right, and you know, it looks like it's smooth motion, but it's not. It's just a series of individual frames, individual pictures. So each of these frames is 1.8 million bits. At 30 frames per second, that's 55.3 million bits per second to show you a 1 second video clip, or about 144 minutes of video without sound if you fill a 60 gigabyte iPod. So you know, 144 minutes is like an hour, 2 hours or so, right? So you know, 60 billion bits sounds like an awful lot. Maybe it sort of is an awful lot, but you really do spend them really fast because every little distinction that you want to be able to make is framed in terms of a bit. Anything else to tell you about this? One of the things that's cool is it turns out that a lot of pictures are compressible. We'll do I'll do a lecture on compression later in the semester, which basically means you don't really need 1.8 million bits for every picture. If a picture is almost entirely blue, then you can take a shortcut and you can basically say, this picture is almost entirely blue. You say that in bits. And any differences between being entirely blue and what you actually see, you just make exceptions. And the number of, to say what the average is, and then the exception to that is often a lot shorter than just naming the colors of every individual square. And so there are ways of kind of making it not take up quite that much space. This happens in video too. What would you think intuitively would be a way to save some of these bits if you're doing video? So in a picture, if there's big splashes that are all the same color, you don't have to say, it's that color again, it's that color again, it's that color again. You can say, here's a color, here's the region for that color. What can you do in video that would actually let you save some bits? What do you think? Any thoughts? What redundancy? Yeah, Charles has an idea. Yeah, what do you think?
If a certain area on the next frame is the same.
Right. So now we've got time that's happening, right? You're showing a series of pictures over time, and sometimes the same, you know, if I just stand here for a second, right, nothing's really changing. And so you might as well just say, there's the frame, it's the same frame. You don't actually have to then repeat every detail of the frame. Just say, it's the same frame for this long, and then it changes. And if you watch, in my house we switched to digital cable recently, and if you watch really closely, you can sometimes see this. You can actually see that it tries very hard to let things be the same for long periods of time. So if somebody's actually standing really still and moves, like it's really moving really slowly, sometimes the algorithms that decide how to compress this will decide that the upper part of the body's moved and the lower body part of the body hasn't. And you get this sort of weird kind of effect where part of the body moves and then the other part of the body moves. It doesn't look smooth because they're trying to say, stay like that as long as you can because that's saving you bits. Why on TV does it matter? Our TV doesn't actually have 60 gigabytes of storage. Why do we want to minimize the number of bits that it takes to display a picture on the television? Where do those, if those bits reside at the cable company and you want to see them on your screen, the more bits that it takes up, the more bandwidth essentially that you're going to take up in transmitting it. So they are trying to save bits in what they send as well as what you store. So anyway, so the point here is it's all bits. And there's lots you can do with them. So what I'd like to do is take a moment to talk a little bit. Let me actually see how I'm doing on time. Sure. All right. So take a minute to talk a little bit about logical variables. So this is another way of looking at bits is they answer the question. They answer yes/no questions. It's hard to think about numbers that way, but I'll explain how you do that. I think 2 lectures from now. But for today, let's actually think about some very simple yes/no questions that we can answer with bits. So here's a propositional variable. Today is Wednesday. This is a true or false statement, and in this case, it's false because it's not Wednesday. It's dark out. It's either true or false, and in this case, we're going to go with false. It's not dark out, and I'm wearing socks. True. All right. Good. So these are 3 different propositional variables. Each of them can take on one of these values. And these are all bit-type values, right? Yes, no values. This is like a 0, this is a 0, this is a 1 for yes. All right. So there are various things that we can do with these. So Hillis tells a very nice story in the first chapter about how he was he was in Calcutta or something like this as a child and had no access to books in English. But he did manage to find a book by George Boole. And Boole was ultimately a very well-known mathematician. I don't think people liked him at the time, but later it turned out that he was actually really onto something. He talked about a kind of algebra of, instead of numbers, of Boolean, well, we call it Boolean variables now, true-false, bit-type values. So the most important operations that we can do on these values are and, or, and not. So these are going to come up an awful lot, so I wanted to introduce them early. So here's the basic idea. If you have, so x, we usually think of x as being a variable that can take on a number, right? Like x is 3, x is 9/2. Right now, x can only take on two values, true or false. Y can only take on two values, true or false. These are Boolean variables. And now here's an expression that combines x and y. We're saying x and y is an expression that is true only if both x and y are true. Okay? So if we're thinking about regular algebra, it might be something like x plus y is an expression that means the sum of x and y, or x divided by y. This is x and y. It's true if x and y are true. It's false otherwise. And this is supposed to correspond, well, I'll show you in a second. It's supposed to correspond to the way we use these words in English. There's also an or. X or y is true only if either x or y is true. Not x is the opposite, right? So if not true is false, not false is true. Flips the value of the bit. So, you know, and again, not is kind of like not. Not something. Or sort of like choice, as long as if either this one or that one is true, we're happy. And is the combination. They both have to be true for the expression to be true. It's a little weird, though. So and generally means and. And in English generally means and, the logical operation. But or in English means, like, anything. So somebody walks up to you and says, your money or your life. And they don't mean the Boolean expression, either your money is true or your life is true. It's actually a more complicated operation. It's basically an XOR. You can have one or the other of these. You can either have your money or you can have your life, but I'm going to take one of them from you, which is not the way that OR is used in Boolean logic. We have a different operator for that we call XOR. All right, so here's some concrete examples. So today is Wednesday, is either true or false, and I am wearing socks, is either true or false. So if we put them together and we say, what's the value of the expression, today is Wednesday and I'm wearing socks? We're going to have to say that that's false, because even though I'm wearing socks, it's not Wednesday. And the only way that an expression with and is going to be true is if they're both true. Okay? So this expression as a whole is false. This is false and true. Give me the answer false. All right, how about it is dark out or I'm wearing socks? Yes, one of these things is true, therefore this expression is true. It turns out that if you answer people, when they ask you OR questions, if you answer as if it's a Boolean expression, they tend to get annoyed with you. Like, would you like chicken or beef? Yes. Yes, I would like chicken or beef. I would like one of those two is definitely what I would want. Waiters just don't like that. And they, you know, they're very polite about it because, you know, the tip and all. But really what they're saying is smart. All right, but in Boolean logic, that's exactly what this expression means. This is true as a whole if either it's dark out or I'm wearing socks. And in this case, because I'm wearing socks, it doesn't matter if it's dark out or not. This is still going to be true, as long as one of them is true. Not it's dark out is true, which again, in English, you would translate it as, you know, is it not dark out or, I guess that's how you would translate it, or is it light out? And the answer for that one would be true. All right, so you're getting the hang of this. We can actually, just like in more complicated expressions, you can make more complicated algebraic expressions. We can also make more complicated Boolean algebraic expressions. So I'll turn the clicker thing on in a moment, but let me at least speak this, and then you can figure out what you want your answer to be. So parentheses and ands and ors, they all mean the same thing as what I was saying. So to figure out the value of an expression like this, you ask, well, is this true or false? Is this true or false? Well, this is not that. So whatever this is going to be the opposite of it. Then you can work out in the parentheses here, what's the value of this OR combination. You can work out what the value of this OR combination is. And now you've got two truth values, and you're going to connect them together with an AND. So the whole thing is true only if both of these two clauses are true. All right? So this should...
You're wearing socks or not?
I am, in fact, wearing socks.
Oh, so it's based on you?
Let's just say that this is... Yeah, sure. Let's say this is based on me. You should take today's Wednesday to be false, You should today start that to be false, and you should take I am wearing socks. Oh, because you may or may not be wearing socks. I could refer to you. Good point. Very good point. Since I didn't know this in advance, you might as well just go with me.
All right, so your clickers will not be registered quite yet. I have to do this first. All right, now you can start.
If you should show the
expression. Now you can't see the expression. Da! There's a chance. Okay, here's another idea. Can we pause this? No. Did you have to, what was the suggestion?
Stop.
Well, if I press stop, then that, yeah, okay, I can press stop. But that basically means we're going to get two questions are the same. All right, so, stare at this until you know the answer. It's going to disappear momentarily when you have to give your answer. I know it's hard to remember one bit, but do your best. All right, I'm going to now flip back to the clicker thing. And somehow I'm going to have to remember that we did this twice. Oh, now, oh, whoa, 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 look at that countdown. We got to make video games based on this. It's just too cool.
Is A false?
Yeah. I made A false because it's like 0 and B true because it's like 1, so I didn't even more. And I'm going to be real consistent about that throughout the semester. All right, good. So now everybody's got theirs in. Okay, not unanimous. Not unanimous. And the thing about binary, it's really hard to give partial credit. Right? Because you either got it entirely right or entirely wrong. I don't know the answer.
Is it true?
I don't know. Well, let's go back to the slide and we'll look at it. So,
all right, we'll break it down step by step. So I am wearing socks is true. So not I am wearing socks is false. Right? I'm not wearing socks. No, that's not true. So today is Wednesday? No. So this or that, they're both false. So this or clause is all false. Now it doesn't matter what this is, because anything and false is going to be false, because they both have to be true for the answer to be true. So the answer should be false or A, and that's what the majority of people say. But now what I was hoping more is for you to understand that process. Right? It's really like evaluating a numeric expression. You have to go from inside the parentheses out. But it takes a little practice to work with these bit dice.
All right, so I'm gonna take us to simple circuits, and then we're gonna have to pick this up next time.
So you know, clearly our brains, or at least 70% of our brains, can answer these sorts of expressions. Can we automate this? Can we make machines that do this? And the answer is yes. And to understand how, I'm gonna get into lights and switches. And you know what? I think maybe it would be best to just be done at this point. I'm going to pick this up next time. You probably won't have to go all the way into chapter 2 of the book. We'll probably only be able to get to finishing chapter 1 next time.